So my talk is called Hyper-Invariant Tensor Networks and Holography. It's about my new paper there. And the joke never gets old, so we're the furthest in Disneyland at the moment. This is the last talk. Okay, so the idea is we want to create a mirror-like tensor network that additionally has extra structure, extra symmetry that's useful for holography. Okay, previous speakers have done a very good job of outlining all of the sort of background information I need in order to tell you about this, so we can go very quickly through this, hopefully. Okay, so here is my mirror. Okay, it's a quantum circuit. I have layers. Here, everything is a unitary gate. This emergent scale, lower layers encode short-range properties, higher layers encode long-range properties. So this emergent scale is an energy scale or a length scale of my quantum state. Oops. And a usual trick we do is instead of talking about unitaries acting on a mapping between a 1D lattice and a bulk lattice, we can think about the bulk degrees of freedom as being fixed. In this case, we can think about a tensor network formed from unitaries and isometries. So, and we usually call these W and U in the canonical notation. Okay. And once we have this structure, again, another interpretation of what this tensor network is describing is very useful to think about each layer as a coarse grating transformation, so something that maps from some initial lattice to some coarser lattice in a 2-to-1 blocking in this case. Okay. If we're using this ansatz to describe a system in which the physics is invariant under changes of scale, then it makes a lot of sense that we should choose the different layers of this network to be the same. Or this is something we find when we try and apply this method to study critical systems. Okay, so this restriction of having the layers the same, we call a scale invariant mirror. Okay, and we've seen a lot of information, details about this. In particular, the scale invariant mirror is very good for representing ground states of lattice CFTs. So if we just throw an icing model at it, optimize for the ground state, with a very cheap calculation, we can reproduce at least the smaller scaling dimensions very, very accurately. We get the fusion coefficients, the OPE coefficients very accurately as well. So scale invariant mirror does fantastic for lattice CFTs. That's never been the problem. But what we want to use it for now is as a model of holography. Okay, so we've already had very many talks outlining this picture here, or with essentially the same picture. So this was the proposal of Brian Swingle that this mirror, this tensor network, has something to do with holography. Maybe it's when I draw it like this, it looks like it could very well be a discretization of a time slice of ADS space. And we've seen a lot of info on that, and it's still not determined how we should interpret this tensor network in terms of holography. This is still something people are working on. What I can say is, coming from the tensor network side of things, this proposal of Brian's has been very useful and has been useful in stimulating new ideas, new algorithms. So thinking about these tensor networks, their properties, from a more geometric perspective has been very useful. And we've seen this as well before, where we have some analogy to Ryu Takayanagi, holographic entanglement entropy, where it's very natural to understand the entanglement scaling through some analog of a minimal surface. Okay, so here the minimal surface is what cuts the minimum number of bulk indices. And in general tensor networks, it's also very useful. You can understand the correlation functions by looking at the sort of minimal paths, the geodesic paths connecting two points. Okay, so regardless of how you interpret holography and mirror, I would say it has been very useful from this perspective. Okay, so scale invariant mirror, drawn it here. It has some very nice properties. It's efficiently contractible. This is how we can do numerics with it, and I'll talk about that more later. It has entanglement and correlation functions sort of arise very naturally from the structure that are compatible with conformal field theories, what we expect. And you can impose the scale invariance on the network. But there is one sort of, I would say, very significant problem is that when I draw it as this tiling, I'm thinking of this, say, just temporarily as a discretization of a ADS time slice, this mirror structure has some inbuilt notion of scale and space that aren't interchangeable. This is more so to do with the fact that I'm restricting to isometric and unitary tensors that impose this direction. So these are fixed. Things behave very differently when looking in these two directions. So this is in contrast with ADS space, which is uniform. So there are many arguments that are based on something to do with this that you could say mirror is not a good model for holography. And I'm not going to go into these, but hopefully can at least convince you that it would be very nice if we could construct a mirror-like tensor network that was uniform in the bulk, that didn't have these fixed space and scale directions. Okay, there has precisely been a proposal that realizes this. So these are the holographic quantum error correcting codes by the HAPI collaboration. Here I've picked the one based on a 4-5 tessellation, so 4-sided plaquettes, 5 index tensors. They have indices connecting to bulk degrees of freedom, but we could just assume they're all fixed just to simplify things for the purpose of this talk. Okay, so these realize, so the problem with the mirror was that you needed isometric constraints and these sort of bias different directions. So how the holographic codes got around this is they said, well, we'll still have isometric constraints, we'll just make them occur in all directions now. So this is how you can have this efficient contractibility in conjunction with this bulk uniform property. Okay. Unfortunately, once I restrict to perfect tensors, this quantum states I can ascribe no longer have these properties compatible with CFTs or critical states. Okay, so once I restrict to perfect tensors, many of my correlation functions become trivial. Okay, so perfect tensors or things close to perfect tensors, I would argue, are not suitable for critical ground states in the sense that I want. And I should just say the work of Tobias Osborne, his talk in the morning, he was talking about these holographic codes that were sort of an infinity three tiling. So these corresponded to tree tensor networks. These are not suitable for the purposes I want either. For instance, a tree tensor network doesn't have the right amount of entanglement for a critical ground state. This was just to avoid confusion, so I'm not going to talk about this type of holographic code anymore today.
But Tobias said, he was working with the tree tensor network all the time.
Yeah.
So he said this is valid for other tessellations. And then he had ones that would not correspond to the tree tensor network.
Yes, in general. Well, the point was you can have this one with a 3-index perfect tensor and everything works. If I put a 3-index perfect tensor on a graph with loops, then it would no longer be contractible. So there's some other problems there that they don't generalize. Okay, so this is the motivation for the talk that I hope you can appreciate. So we have this mirror over here that has some constraints that allow it to be efficiently contractible, that make it a viable numeric scheme. It works very well for conformal field theories, but it has these preferred directions and locations in the bulk. We have the holographic codes that are uniform in the bulk, efficiently contractible, but are then not compatible with CFTs. So that's our goal today, is to try and build a tensor network that captures the desirable aspects of sort of both of these guys. And this is what I'm going to call a hyper-invariant tensor network, as shorthand for a network which is invariant on the hyperbolic disk in a way that I'll describe. Okay, so that was the motivation. I'm doing pretty good time. Okay, so So this is one example of something I'm going to build. So here I'm building a network based on what is called a 7-3 hyperbolic tessellation. So all of my plaquettes have seven edges, all of my tensors, I'm gonna place a tensor I call A on the vertices of this tiling. So A have three indices. I'm gonna place a matrix B on each of the edges. Okay, and I could, so you could consider the case where you have free bulk indices of these tensors. I'm not gonna consider that for this talk. Okay. So if we put the same copies of the A and B tensor at every location, and if we constrain them to be rotationally invariant, or A is rotationally invariant, B is symmetric, then you recover this bulk uniform property. Okay, so this is just the simplest way we can do this. And what I want to say is there are very many other schemes you could, tessellations, you could build an equivalent hyperinvariant tensor network from, but today we're just gonna focus on this one here, the 7-3 one. Okay, and it will be useful for later purposes. Okay, so once we have this tensor network, we can draw it in a slightly different way. We can do this unwrapping where we, if we pick a point to serve as the top of the network, then we can unwrap it into layers around this point. Okay, so this unwrapping is unique. So each layer is just an interconnected string of A and B tensors. Okay, when we do this unwrapping, we see it looks kind of like a mirror in some ways. One main difference is now each layer over here, rather than being translations of a single unit cell, now has two different types of unit cell that can occur depending on what sort of was above it in the previous layer. And the pattern of these two and three site unit cells as I extend to infinity is fractal. So there's no repeating finite pattern of these guys. Another way of seeing this is the scale factor of this ansatz is irrational. So the if I have some lattice with some number of sites, I map to some number of sites divided by S, where S is irrational. Okay. So this is sort of the basics for having a tensor network which is uniform in the bulk. Now I want to ask the question, what additional constraints can I put on this that recover my efficient contraction, or what I'm going to interpret as preservation of locality as an RG map? Okay, so before we do that, we're just gonna revisit mirror and the holographic codes to see a bit more how they work. Okay, so we're going back to mirror. I'm looking at a single layer of my mirror network, and again, I want to interpret it as a coarse graining transformation between an initial and a coarser lattice over here. Okay, why we need the isometric and unitary constraints, or why they're really useful, is that they allow a local operator here to be mapped to a local operator in the coarser lattice. Okay, so how this works, so we have our operator, we're acting with a layer V and its conjugate. We just apply these isometric constraints and we see that many things cancel out. Okay, so everything cancels out except this local region, and this is how we define our coarse-grained operator. Okay, so two-site operators map to two-site operators. And as I said, this is practically very important as this allows us to contract things efficiently numerically, have a viable numeric scheme. It's also, I would argue, conceptually important. This is how we define scaling operators in the mirror and so forth. So if we didn't have this locality, I don't know how you would interpret scaling operators or how they might work. You would need some different formalism. Okay, so that's with mirror. What about with the holographic codes? So I'm not gonna talk about a particular implementation of the holographic code. I just wanna understand more generally, once I have perfect tensors, what goes wrong with the scheme? So I'm just imagining I have some coarse graining transformation built from perfect tensors. So here I have four index tensors, and I'm assuming they're constrained to be isometric across all partitions between two indices and two indices, or three and one. Okay, so imagine I'm doing my coarse graining transformation. This also preserves locality, but you can see a problem with what's happening here is when I do this transformation, many things cancel, but too many things cancel. So these cancel with themselves. Once they go over here, this one can now cancel with itself as well, because two indices match two indices on the bottom in the conjugate. So what I have is that any operator I put here is coarse-grained to a trivial operator on the higher lattice. Okay, so another way of interpreting this is when I build a network out of these perfect tensors, there is going to be at least some trivial correlation functions happening. Okay, and structurally trivial correlation functions just that come from the constraints we've put on the tensors. Okay, so this immediately implies to me, at least, that this is not something I want to consider as a model, like trying to represent the ground state of a CFT with, like they don't have trivial correlators. Okay, but I mean, this is for the purposes of having a quantum error correcting code, then this is completely acceptable. Okay, so this is the story so far. We have these isometric constraints. They give us locality, but they're not strong enough to be compatible with bulk uniformity. We have these perfect tensor constraints that allow us to have bulk uniformity, but they're too strong. They kill too many of the correlation functions. So what we really want is some kind of Goldilocks constraint. We want to meet somewhere in the middle with strong, but not too strong. So this is my idea for how to achieve that, is using what I call multi-tensor constraints. So in this, what I'm doing here is, rather than imposing constraints on individual tensors of my network, I'm saying that certain products of these A and B tensors should together form isometries in different ways. So two of the Bs together with an A should form an isometry W, five Bs together with three As should form an isometry I call U that maps from three to two indices. Okay, and the question of how you find A and B tensors that satisfy these properties will be one we'll address later on. Okay, but let's just see where these constraints take us. So here is my layer of the 7-3 network. Once I'm allowed to group together into isometries, so now everything in this layer is an isometry. So overall, this layer is an isometric mapping between one lattice and the next. But this grouping is not unique, of course. There are many ways I can do it. You'll see. So now I want to ask the question, does this constraint allow me to have the proper locality as an RG map that I would desire? Okay, so I'm going to look at my operator down here. I'm going to do the coarse graining transformation. Okay, so this is one way I can do it. My V and my V dagger. I look at this diagram and I see, oh, I can group the tensors together into isometries in certain ways. Many of these cancel out with their conjugates. I'm left with a local operator at the end of this. Okay, so this is what we want. But you may also object to this. You can say, well, I could have grouped my tensors in a slightly different way, which looks like I come out with a different operator at the end of it. I would say this is fictitious in the sense that no property of this coarse graining can depend on this grouping. This grouping is just something that occurs in our imagination. We're not actually changing any property of the network. So when I have this two-side operator come out here, it must be the case that one side of this operator is trivial anyway. Like these must be equivalent. So it makes sense, if I want to understand what is the non-trivial part of a coarse-grained operator, then I should choose the grouping that gives the minimal support in this coarse-graining transformation. Okay. Okay, and what I've drawn here is, through one layer of the network, all the possible ways in which a two-side or a one-side operator can map. Okay, so all of these, again, are just looking at how I could, what is the minimum, what grouping results in the minimal support of the coarse-grained operator. And as we can see, we have this constraint, we have this condition of locality fulfilled. If we start off with a one or a two-side operator, it maps to a one or a two-side operator. So this allows us to do things efficiently. At the same time, we don't have these trivial coarse gratings that we had with perfect tenses. There are no sites down here which coarse grained is something trivial in general. Okay, so hopefully I've convinced you that this notion of multi-tensor constraints is sort of at least an acceptable condition that's sort of just right. It's strong enough that we have this locality that we want. It's not too strong as to kill off the correlation functions. Okay, and this also has an interesting consequence that we'll talk more about later. So before we said we would choose some point and organize our network into layers around this point. And so we can choose, so we have this equivalent of a center of orthogonality that we are allowed to move around this network as we see fit. So any point I choose, I can organize it in layers, my tensor network in layers around this point. Each layer now is an isometric mapping from one scale to the next. Okay, so this just let me summarize what I've said so far about this network. I generate a network based on some tessellation of the hyperbolic disk. I have constraints which relate to uniformity. I have constraints which are compatible with bulk uniformity that allow this to be an efficient network that give it the sort of the RG properties that we want. Okay, and we haven't enforced any trivial correlation functions by these constraints. I might say a bit more about that later. And in general, the correlators are very similar to what we have in the mirror. So if I just take a random instance of this network, if I look on special sites, I get exact polynomial decay of correlators. If I don't look at special sites, I get some rough polynomial decay that relates just coming from the geometry of the path lengths in the network.
Mm-hmm. When you look at a subregion of the boundary of subsystem and look at the entropy.
Yeah, we'll probably get to this later. Is it? Yeah. So these are the two directions we can go at this point. We can ask what are some interesting implications of these constraints on this network. And then later on, I'll talk about how to actually solve for these A and B tensors. So I think this will directly go into what you're talking about. Okay, so let's look at these implications. So one very interesting implication, I think, is that in this hyperinvariant network, we have some very nice connection between entanglement wedges and causal cones. Okay, so we have a minimal surface, the entanglement wedge. I'm going to define the causal cone, even though it's not really a cone in most cases, as the set of tensors that can affect the reduced density matrix of some boundary region. Okay, and what we see is this very nice property that in most cases the causal cones and the entanglement wedges are exactly coincident. And I'm going to put a little disclaimer here. In some particular cases, it may be that C is slightly larger than the entanglement wedge. Okay, so we have this geometric interpretation of the causal cones that certainly is not there in the mirror. And this is sort of a direct consequence of this shiftable center of orthogonality. Okay, so let me give you an example of this. Here is my hyperinvariant network, organized into layers. If I wanted to evaluate the density matrix on some region, what I would find is when I take the network with itself and trace out everything outside of this region, many, many tensors will cancel due to these multi-tensor constraints. The ones I'm left with, the ones that don't cancel, are precisely the ones that sit within this entanglement wedge. Okay? And this is something, as I said, you generically see for almost all connected intervals on the boundary. Okay, let me give you a few more examples. So these are for 1, 2, and 3 site regions. So I'm just thinking about them separately. I've just drawn them all on one diagram. Okay, so in all cases, the causal cone that contains the tensors in the density matrix are all entanglement wedges. Okay, so if I look at this case here, I have a 3-site region. My entanglement wedge is the one that cuts through 2 bulk indices. The density matrix is precisely defined or given from the tensors within this region with their conjugates. Okay, so in this case, all of my 1, 2, and 3 sites obey this holographic causality, as I called it. Okay, so let's get some understanding of why this happens. Okay, so here is my network. I've unwrapped it around a bulk point. One thing that's very useful for me to define is what I call an apparent causal cone. So this is the causal cone that arises when I look sort of layer by layer at the causal properties. Okay, so the apparent causal cone can depend on where I choose my center. Somehow the real causal cone has to be a subset of this apparent causal cone. And this apparent causal cone is something you can understand much more easily because of the similarities between a layer of this network and a layer of mirror. The apparent causal cone in this hyperinvariant network is roughly the same as a normal causal cone in a mirror that has the same center. So our argument for understanding this nature of this holographic causality is very simple. So imagine I had this network, I choose T here, I look at this apparent causal cone, I look at the entanglement wedge of this region. What I could understand is that I should shift where I choose my center of orthogonality to be somewhere within this region. When I do this and I look at the apparent causal cone, now it lines up perfectly with the entanglement wedge. Okay, so this is sort of the choice of the center for this particular region that minimizes the apparent causal cone. So one thing I would like to say about this, or something that makes it much more easy to understand what's going on, is that the center of orthogonality in the hyperinvariant network is very similar to choosing the center of orthogonality in a matrix product state in its canonical form. And so for those who are familiar with tensor networks, you have a matrix product state, you have this very nice canonical form, which essentially realizes a Schmidt decomposition across all cuts simultaneously. What we mean by that is if I choose a center, then everything to the left is an orthonormal basis, everything to the right is an orthonormal basis. Okay, so what this means is the tensors obey these rules that if I take the weights in from one side, I get an isometry. If I take the weights in from the other side, I get an isometry. So everything on the left can form an isometry, everything on the right can form an isometry for any chosen center. Okay, so if I have this matrix product state and I want to evaluate the density matrix of some local region, I can organize things into isometries. All of the isometries cancel, so all I'm left with is the tensors that are connected to this region. Okay, and this is a almost identical property to what we saw in the hyperinvariant network with this shiftable center of orthogonality. So I would really say that one way of understanding how this works is thinking that these multi-tensor constraints are really some sort of generalization of these sort of canonical form constraints on the matrix product state. So in general, once we have a tensor network with loops, there is no such thing as a canonical form, at least not based on the Schmidt decomposition. Here, we've generalized an important feature of this canonical form from the 1D line to the hyperbolic disk. Okay. Other implications that I find interesting. So one is that now for any region we like, we have this analytic form of the density matrix. So I can draw you what the density matrix looks like as a closed form representation in terms of these A and B tensors. Okay, so this closed form representation doesn't exist in normal mirror. Your tensor network for a density matrix is an infinite tensor network. Okay.
This is the causal cone. Mm-hmm. Is the causal cone of the complement the same as the complement of the causal cone? Complement of R.
Yeah.
What is the causal cone of that?
I don't know. Probably what you said, but I haven't thought about that. So
when you say you can calculate the reduced density matrix of rho R, that's because you know how to trace over R complement.
Yes.
And that means there's an isometry from this dashed line to the complement?
from the dashed line to the complement. I don't know off the top of my head. Probably.
The problem is if you have this line, this cut, say the boundary of your quadratic cone, then there is asymmetry to the R. There's also asymmetry to R complement. Then that means your density matrix has a flat spectrum. I don't know if that's the case.
It doesn't.
No. The small balls, the bits will have to jump from one side.
Yeah, they don't. You don't have a flat spectrum for your density matrix. I can prove this.
So there is an asymmetry to R complement, but not somehow.
Yes. I will have to think about that a bit more. But another thing I can say about this, so I learned these fancy words yesterday in talk of James. So this subregion duality, if we had this density matrix on this region, if you gave me this, could I reconstruct what these tensors are in this causal wedge? In this case, so I haven't thought about this enough to say conclusively, but it looks like there is some very easy way to do this. Okay, and again, this is not something you would expect to be able to do with Mera. Yes, it seems possible. Again, one more feature I will say is that if I look at the a boundary region, if I'm looking at a three-site reduced density matrix, in this hyperinvariant network, I only get one of three options, row A, row B, or row C. Compared to the Mera, if I look at a three-site density matrix, every single one is going to be different. Okay, once I optimize it for the ground state of a translation invariant system, these differences will get smaller. But in this case, I think it's very interesting. Even without optimization, I have many of the density matrices are exactly the same. Maybe this could suggest that this somehow is better for translation invariant states. I don't know. Okay, so that was just some very nice features that you get once you have this bulk uniformity that the Mera doesn't have ordinarily. Okay, I'm sure there are many more things you could say about this network. Yeah?
These causal cones for disjoint regions, are they always disjoint or is it possible for them to circle?
The causal cone for disjoint regions is going to be joint. You have to have that to have correlation. So the causal cone for region A joint with region B is more than their individual causal cones joint. There is
they're generic,
like all of the correlators are non-trivial. They have to join. Okay, so I'll just say very quickly how we can go about solving these constraints on these tensors. So in general, I have very many solutions that at least satisfy some necessary properties for an ansatz. So I have solutions that have free parameters. You can have as many free parameters as you like. The entanglement and correlation functions depend on these parameters and are non-trivial. Okay, I don't know what is the most general solution or what is the best parameterization for practical purposes. This is still something that needs to be figured out. Okay, so the example I'm going to show you is made from the idea that I should endow these tensors with some finer structure. So I'm imagining decomposing each of these indices as a product of finer indices and then building these tensors from some smaller tensors on these finer indices. Okay, so once I've done this, then I have these constraint equations where this set of tensors should form an isometry, this set of tensors should form a different isometry. These can be solved just through some simple constraints on these finer tensors that you can realize and that have free parameters and that I'm not going to tell you about. Okay, so we can do this. I'll just show you very quickly. So here, just based on the solution, I've just chosen some variational parameters that's from this parameterization of the solution at random. And here I've constructed a three-site density matrix and computed its spectrum. Okay, so what we see is that the spectrum is non-trivial. The spectrum depends on the choice of parameters we put in. Okay, so these are things we expect. And likewise, if we look at a scaling superoperator and computer spectrum of scaling dimensions, we get something in both cases that's non-trivial that depends on the parameters we put in. And all of the different scaling operators have non-trivial spectrum. All of the combinations have non-trivial spectrum. In general, I would say all of the correlation functions are non-trivial. Like it seems very similar to a mirror in this regards. Okay. And I'm inclined to, originally I thought this was just some trick to satisfy these constraints I have. I'm now inclined to think about this maybe more seriously, and that we can think about some network that breaks bulk invariance at some finer structure, and bulk invariance is something that emerges once we sort of zoom out enough. That this may be some sort of more, this may be more than a trick to solve the tensor equations. Okay, let me just summarize. Okay, so I told you how you can construct these networks that keep a lot of the interesting properties of mirror, but have much more symmetry as well. So we could put in these bulk indices. We could talk about networks constructed on other geometries. I think we need to, a lot more work needs to be done in order to characterize what type of quantum states these networks describe. Can these describe ground states of critical systems? How should I interpret this in terms of holography? One thing I can say is at least some instances of the perfect tensor holographic codes can be thought of as specific instances of a hyperinvariant network. Okay, so in this one here, which I didn't talk about, the perfect tensor is also a solution to the multi-tensor constraints. So they're sort of very finely tuned instances of what I call a hyperinvariant network. Okay, we also, if you want to do these numerically, you need to solve a lot of things as well that I haven't done yet. So how to implement the multi-tensor constraints in the best way, how to optimize many things. But that is something, a direction you could certainly go. Okay, so we've gone from scale invariant mirror, which has fixed directions of scale and space. The goal was to keep the nice properties of mirror and add this bulk uniformity, add much more symmetry, and we get this hyperinvariant network, aka mirror on steroids.
Are those your arms?
No, I wouldn't. Thank you for your attention.
That's okay. So you've managed to keep all the nice properties at extra, but there is an extra change that happened, right? Because this causality structure that we described implies that two-side or a finite range Hamiltonian at the boundary, the expectation value will be sensitive to the tensors in the bound. And I don't see this as a defect necessarily, as a problem, but it's actually... Well, it's reflecting something that happened in holography as well, right? That if you try to think of this tensor network as representing a wave function at the boundary, and you were to optimize the tensor network, there is no, you can change the tensors in the middle and not change the expectation value.
Not quite. Like if you coarse grain the Hamiltonian through the first layer, and you ask what is the optimization problem now, it's non-trivial. You can't consider the layers independently or the tensors independently because there are these constraints that act between them. Like if you somehow moved in the direction of the optimization that preserved these tensor constraints, then I agree it would be insensitive, but it's not clear.
You're saying that the tensor network, you have to make changes which are rigid, but if you change one tensor, you have to change all of them? I'm just saying, the tensor symmetries of the boundary some small part of the land is independent of what you
want. So I don't know if you can make local changes in such a way that you still, everything else is satisfied. I mean, it's the same as a matrix product state. If you wanted to make a local change of this tensor such that it was still in canonical form, it's maybe not so straightforward, though doable.
So that's very interesting. So if I generalize this, if I want to think about something like excited states, what people are talking about, then I can allow these tensors to be different. Then there is there a generalization of these conditions you write down?
So in general, I can have, I'm allowed to have all of these tensors different and all of the directions different. Everything still works so long as the multi-tensor constraints are satisfied in all instances. So the bulk uniformity is not actually essential to all of these properties. It's just the multi-tensor part, the isometric part.
So there's some form of rigidity. The constraints, they have to be simultaneously fulfilled throughout the tensor network.
Yes.
That may mean that you cannot change just parameters locally there. It may or may not mean.
Yeah, it's
the constraints pierce the entanglement surface. So now they like constrain you beyond.
Yes.
Other questions? Yeah. But bulk uniformity, by that you mean essentially scale invariance, right? So you have, you know, the coloring you put in here, that's just a way of deciding the age, right?
That was just a way of making it more obvious when for a particular layering. Like scale invariance is invariance just in one direction.
Right, okay.
Bulk uniformity is like any invariance, like it's the same if I choose any point in any direction. I can't tell where.
Well, I mean, is the tensors are the same everywhere. That's bulk uniformity.
Yes.
But the coloring is just where you choose your center, which is something.
Oh, just ignore the coloring. It was just to make a particular layering more obvious.
Okay, but you talked about moving the center, and that's just choosing different compositions of the A's and B's in different places.
Well, it was more of a theoretical construct of like. Understanding the choice of center is just something I choose organized to make it easy to see.
Okay.
It's not something physical.
Okay. I just wanted I actually wanted to ask, since you've got a local density matrix, which really is just the boundary of your network.
Mm-hmm.
So if I gave you the exact local density matrix for the criticalizing model, does that mean you can? Could just use that to optimize the tensors in a very local way.
That would be the idea, though. I think it's more like you have to have these multi-tensor constraints satisfied, which is more difficult as well.
Right.
So I don't. Yeah, in principle, that was you could, but that brings the issue Giffrey was talking about as well.
But if you ask it in a different way, then your density matrix is eventually a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So when you find a solution where the density matrix has a unique I'm trying to say, can you already cook up parent Hamiltonian with this other ground, local parent Hamiltonian with your state at ground?
I think in some sense, yes. So it's going to be a parent Hamiltonian with high degeneracy.
With degeneracy?
Yes. I don't know how you could have a parent Hamiltonian with a unique ground state.
Okay.
If that's what you mean by parent Hamiltonian, then.
Do you solve them numerically, the tensor constraints, or do you have an analytic way?
Well, I had it at the very end, this was an analytic way, like I can tell you some solutions to these tensors that have parameters that they satisfy these constraints all the time. Though maybe in practice it might be better to just impose the constraints at the level of numerics rather than try and find an analytic solution, as in this case.
Do you think you can even change the center tensor, for example, in some way that it doesn't satisfy this condition? Can you numerically bring it? I guess what happens is that you will insert something that, like tensors on every light that will move towards the boundary. So it's a possible thing that at the end you end up with some non-trivial thing on the boundary and the thing is still inside the boundary. It's unitary.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's very useful to think of it in connection with what would happen in the canonical matrix product states if you did something like
that. What
happened with that. Maybe. Yeah.
All right, let's take the remaining questions to lunch. Thank you very much.